introduction to John, we see that John in chapter 20 said that there were certain signs that he picked. Many more were done. These were written that we might believe. Bonus point, how many particular signs did John pick to record in this gospel? There's a hint.
Seven.
Okay, so we're going to see the first one this morning. There are, I think, probably four different sections in this lesson. If you're in the workbook, it's lesson number four, and it covers the entirety of John chapter 2. And the first section it appears to me, and I think the author agrees, it appears to be a continuation toward the end of chapter 1 that we saw, you know, on the next day and on the next day and on the next day. It kind of went through a chronology because he starts chapter 2 and verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. It would appear to be that that's following in succession of one of these next days that he talked about. If I could get somebody to volunteer to read chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, that will get us through the first section. Sam said he's got it.
On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were six stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast had tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water did, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone who serves the good wine first, everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine, but you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed.
Okay. So, the first part that we're talking about this morning, there's a wedding, and some of the people we know that were there were Mary, Jesus' mother. Jesus was there, and some of his disciples. And Mary notices there may be a problem. And what was the problem? So what? What's the problem? I will tell you from personal experience, and some of y'all were there, but you would not have known of my fears that day. But Kay and I have had sponsored two weddings with receptions at the Fairfield Inn. You sweat bullets that they're not going to run out of food, that something's not going to happen bad. Some of the best memories that I have, but you worry about that kind of thing. And then let's take it one step further. According to everything I can read, a wedding feast, a wedding celebration at this time would have lasted 7 days. And I'm just thinking, if some of y'all thought y'all went to a different party than we did, it was the Fairview Inn and not whatever I said. Wasn't at a hotel.
I just told Charlotte, Okay.
There was something ringing in there and it wasn't sitting right. But this feast would have lasted 7 days. I don't know if I would have made it through. I would have been so worried. But like Bill pointed out, it would have been a poor reflection upon the family that was responsible for providing that feast. And some of the, I read so many commentaries and things when I'm doing this, I don't remember if it's in the book or where it comes from, but they talked about that this would be kind of like a thing that would travel with this newly married couple for the remainder of their days. You know, they're on their 20th anniversary, everybody's there and say, hey, remember, they're the ones that ran out of wine. It would have been a very poor reflection. And I didn't delve deep enough to see exactly what it meant, but several commentators said that the provider of the feast could also be potentially held liable in like a civil action. So I've got to find it, just because I'm a lawyer, it intrigued me a little bit. I got to find out a little bit about it. I don't know if that's part of the dowry and maybe they messed up. You know, I don't know, but that's interesting. But Mary notices that they ran out of wine. That's going to be an issue for this family. So what does Mary do? Was Jesus in the business, as far as we know, of making wine? Was that his business?
No.
He's a carpenter. In verse 4, what does Jesus reply to her?
What
does that mean? Yeah. And as all of the commentaries you can read and even the workbook points out, this is not a derogatory type thing that he says to his mother. In English, we might read it that way, but that's not a derogatory type thing, you know. And I think he's just kind of saying, you know, it's their party. You know, what's that to us, Bill?
Well, he also followed up by saying it's not the right time.
Yeah.
So
what do you think that means? So does that give you any insight, Reed, as to what his mother thought he should do? I do not believe at all that Mary thought telling Jesus they don't have any wine was a hint to him, hey, run down to the supermarket and get some more wine and bring it. That's not what she meant. And I think that we read where Jesus says, my hour has not come, that I think it's a ready inference from that she expected him to do something miraculous.
That's also interesting because he was still obedient.
Yes. And I really like verse 5. It tells us so much about Mary. What does verse 5 just say? She looks at the servants that are around and says what? Do it. She expected that Jesus was going to do something, and even if some of the servants may have had some questions about it, she just says, do it. It's kind of like, trust me, do it. Bill. not likely. But she had so much confidence in him. I am glad that the scriptures do not tell us all of these little childhood details. But just think, Mary has spent 30 years with Jesus, almost on a daily basis. And if you recall, how was Mary originally, I'm going to say, introduced to Jesus? How did that happen? An angel. The Holy Spirit's going to come upon you and you will be with child. Don't forget that with Mary and Jesus. She, better than anyone, knew the origins of Jesus. And she has this opportunity there. Verse 5, Mother said to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. What happened next? Okay, we have how many water pots? Approximately how much capacity of each one? 20, 30 gallons. There's some differentiation through the various measurements that we have. They didn't use gallons, okay? But as best we can tell, and that ranges anywhere from a total of 105 gallons up to 180 gallons, depending upon conservative measurements and how they take it. That's a lot, isn't it? I think it is. If somebody told me to go to the store and get 100 gallons of sweet tea, and I had to do it by myself, that's a lot of jugs to carry out. You know, I'd call Reed and Bill and somebody else to come help me do that, probably. But he told them there are 6 water pots. We know the capacity. Verse 7, he tells them, fill the water pots with water. And note the detail. What did they do? Well, before that, he told them to fill the water pots. And what detail do we get from what they did?
They filled the brim.
What does that mean, old Southern folks? We fill something to the brim. What is that? It's to the top. Okay. Does that detail, is that detail of any importance to you in believing the miracle? If somebody wants to argue this really wasn't a miracle, something else happened, I bet you what they did is he had that water in there and they just added grape juice to it. Can that happen with this detail that was given to us? There's no more room in the water pots. They're filled to the brim. I think the detail is there for us on purpose, so one of those arguments goes out the door. There's not any additional room there. And so they fill to the brim. He told them, draw some out, take it to the master of the feast. Best I can tell, this is like the caterer that's in charge of everything. You know, the person that makes sure there's food, drink, refreshments, the person that's in charge. Take it to him, and what did he observe when they took this to him? Verse 9 and following. Good quality stuff, okay? And so then he goes to the bridegroom and they have that conversation. And then in verse 11, this beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee manifested his glory and his disciples believed in him. Somebody tell me what a sign is, or what is its purpose? If you see a stop sign, what does that mean and do? Stop, you get an A+. Okay. a sign, as used here, that we're talking about, and also the way we would use it, just remember that a sign is to signify something. When you see that stop sign, it signifies there is a command that you are to stop, or that you are to yield, or that you are to proceed slowly, whatever that may be. So it signifies something. What did, according to verse 11, what do you think this sign that Jesus did, what was it trying to signify?
Show that those disciples that were with him, who were standing there when he did that, that he does have a miraculous power. And he is what he says he is, and that is the Son of God.
Okay, just in verse 11 it said it manifested his glory. Okay, that's not humanity. There's the power, the deity that's there, and the result of the sign was that his disciples believed in him. Now, just throwing back, we covered this last week in chapter 1 and verse 50, when the first disciples were being collected. We had this issue with Nathanael that Jesus said, I saw you when you were under the fig tree before you came here. And because of that, Nathanael, I believe. And in verse 50, Jesus answered and said to him, because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than this. And if this chronology is correct, this is on the third day then, has that encounter with Nathanael. And on the third day, look what he got to see.
Yeah. Even in those days, the finest wine was aged. It took more than 20 seconds to produce fine wine.
Yeah. Well, it in verse 9, what detail do we also get so that we don't have any? It takes out another one of these details, adds another one of these details for us to say. In verse 9, if we had any doubt, what does John tell us? They didn't know where it came from. It said, when the master of the feast had tasted what? The water that had been made wine. Okay. John's not leaving anything to your imagination. He's just telling you that water had become wine. Read. Depends on how much time y'all want to take in class about some of these things that we get from this. And some, maybe we imagine. Some, maybe, are there for a purpose. Let's just at least talk about that for a second anyway. Jesus had been compared to what great prophet in the Old Testament? Moses, okay? When Moses was sent by God to deal with Pharaoh for the 10 plagues, what was the first miracle that he did to Pharaoh? Nile River became blood. Okay, water was turned to blood with Moses. Is that a foreshadowing of the first sign Jesus does is water to wine? What was the purpose of Pharaoh going, of Moses going to Pharaoh? What did he want to do? Set my people free. Let them loose from bondage. Is that not what Jesus does for us? know, you compare those great prophets that are there. With this being stone water pots that were used for purification, what does Jesus and his blood do for us? We get purified through that process. Our sins are remitted. Bill? And maybe again as a foreshadowing, he turns water to wine. It's water that was part of the purification process. What are the elements of the Lord's Supper? You know, wine, the fruit of the vine. We're thinking about his blood that was shed there. Now, nobody has been brave enough to broach this subject yet directly in class. I appreciate that because we probably don't have enough time for it. Are you troubled by the fact that it talks about wine? You know, every one of us in here could have 20 different articles, totally separate and distinct from everybody else, on all the stuff that's written about this. And it kind of depends a little bit upon your bias and prejudice. Most of the articles I read start out with not the one that I'm subscribing to. It's in by vast majority when you start reading them. Well, see, this is proof. We can drink alcoholic beverages. That's just proof of this here. And you got to really kind of think about this a little bit in context. The word for wine here, I believe, is pronounced oinos, O-I-N-O-S, and that term in and of itself doesn't tell you anything about whether it's alcoholic or not. That term is used from the grape juice that first comes out of the press of crushing the grapes up to alcoholic. So that term doesn't tell you anything. So just the fact that somebody wants to turn and point to you and say, see, they're drinking wine right here, that doesn't tell you anything. You're assuming something that's there. Reed? And it's interesting that there is, if you go back and look at the literature of the day, I'm going to call them recipe books, but if you would be looking at the recipe books, or you would be looking at the social guidelines, one of the biggest debates, I guess, among the crusty, upper crusty class, was what's the proper way to dilute wine. If the wine had become fermented and had an alcohol content, first, as Reed points out, it's baby stuff compared to what distilled beverages are today. But even with that small amount of alcoholic content, there's a great dispute upon mixing the wine with water. What's the proper dilution? It would seem to be that one of the fair and most common would be one part wine and add three parts water. So there's a further dilution there of any alcoholic content if there may be. And just if you're trying to have some tool in your arsenal, if someone was to say that, see, they drank wine there, oh, let's go have some alcohol. If you look at Proverbs 3, verses 9 and 10, it talks about there that, in context, if you're serving God, you're giving him your first fruit, your barns are also always going to be full, But in verse 10, it ends up that talking about one of the things that will always be full is your vats, where you press the grape and get new wine. Same term that's there. And that's one of the places you can show that just grape, you know, if you put them in a vat and you squish them, like the Lucy show, and the grape juice comes out, it's not fermented, folks. That hasn't had time to happen. That takes time. But the term in Proverbs 9 and 10 talks about that as new wine. So it uses that same terminology. Still talking about, Reed was talking about, or got us off on this track a little bit, I'll blame him, about, you know, what other things do we see here? Let's just use the round number and say that each of these stone water pots had 20 gallons. Okay? So that's 120 gallons of water that became wine. Is that a lot or not much? What do you think?
Depends on the size of the crowd.
Pardon?
Depends on the size of the crowd.
Yeah. It strikes me as a lot for a wedding feast, even if it's going to last 7 days. And I wonder if we also see the abundance provided by Christ. That's a stretch a little bit, but just think about the abundance. And I just started, when I started thinking about that, I was wondering, okay, how does this filter out? And went back and actually found an article that people are writing about this stuff, folks. And the historians and the archaeologists were of the opinion that by artifacts they have found and other writings, that about 4 ounces would have been like the size of the container, you know, for these refreshments being served. I guess that was their version of the Red Solo cup. A little bit smaller, but if you had 120 gallons and a serving to a guest was 4 ounces, and it was mixed 3 parts water to 1 part wine, that's approximately 15,000 servings. So I think even with the crowd they might have had, that's a fair amount when they already said that, you know, they've already had some, and they ran out. But just the abundance of what Jesus provided there, you know, so say my math's wrong, which could be, say it's 10,000 servings. That's still a pretty good bit. But we have the water turned to wine. Verse 11, it's the beginning of the signs that Jesus did. The sign manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Okay. Anything else, questions, comments about the water to wine before we go to the next section? It doesn't make as much sense maybe to us, but the purification ritual, they would have washed hands during this feast for before something happened. And the point of it being a stone pot for purification, stone doesn't take up the impurities that may be there like a clay water pot would. That's the two examples that are usually given. The clay would just absorb the impurities. And then you put water in the clay pot again, and the impurities get back in the water. It doesn't matter what kind of water you have. But with these stone water pots, for the purpose of purification, would remain pure. I can't help but see that that's some sort of a foreshadowing, of Jesus and his role in this. Okay, if somebody wants to then read the next section, you only have to read verse 12. Bill's going to do it.
After this, he went down to Capernaum, he, his mother, his brothers, and his disciples, and they did not stay there any days.
Okay. We're just given another detail, as John is kind of do in this chronology. After this, the wedding feast, they went down to Capernaum. He, his mother, his brother, his disciples, and they did not stay there many days because something's about to happen again. Anything of interest you see in that? With the mention of Mary and Joseph and his brothers, who's not mentioned there? And this is where a lot of conjecture comes in, but there's no mention of Joseph, his earthly father. The conjecture is he may have already passed by this time for whatever reason. If you're just making marginal notes, John 7, 1 through 5 mentions brothers. Matthew 13, 55 through 56 mentions brothers and a sister. So Jesus had siblings. And we know that from later on. One of his brothers becomes very prominent in the church in Jerusalem after coming to a belief which he did not have earlier. Okay. All right. Next section, verses 13 through 22. Who will read that? Ori?
The Passover of the Jews was here, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And he found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves and money changers seated at their tables. And he made a scourge of cords and drove them all out of the temple, with the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And to those who were selling the doves, he said, "Take these things away. Stop making my father's house a place of business." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume you." The Jews then said to him, "What sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews then said, "It took 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking of the temple of his body. So when he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he said this, and they believed the scripture that whoever was Jesus had done.
Okay. So the next thing that we consider is that Jesus went to Jerusalem for Passover of the Jews. Somebody recount for me, what is the Passover? Last plague, death of the firstborn. What prohibited the death from entering into the camp of the Hebrews? Blood of the lamb spread over the doorpost. There's also the feast, if you will, that they partook of. The lamb, the unleavened bread, special way to dress, be ready to leave in a hurry, eat in haste. But this is one of those annual feasts. Deuteronomy chapter 16 is one of the places you'll find that, celebrating when they're brought out of Egypt. Verses 16 and 17 tells that that's one of the three feasts that they were supposed to keep each year. And something that may be important in just a moment, there were sacrifices that were required as part of this feast. So Jesus is going to observe this Passover. This is one of the required feasts, remembering them being brought out of Egypt. And verse 14, when Jesus got into Jerusalem and he got to the temple, what did he find? Money changers, one thing we need to know about. What else did he find? Okay, so he gets there. Verse 14, he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers doing business. Why would those be around the temple? Now, keep in mind, this is more than likely, they're not in the Holy of Holies or any of those places. More than likely it's the court of the Gentiles where various people could commingle, but it was still part of the temple complex. Why would there be people there selling sheep and oxen and doves? Okay. Required under the Passover that sacrifices be made. Those were those animals. Why would they need to be there selling them?
Convenience.
I'm sorry?
Convenience.
Convenience. Why convenience? Okay. These were for Jews coming from, you know, all over. I guess you could, you know, try to bring your sacrificial animal with you if you wanted to, but As Levi said, there's a convenient place. Sacrifices needed to be done. Opportunity to make money. Not only as a convenience, but opportunity to make money. Why would money changers need to be there? Temple tax.
Also, some of them might have brought Roman coins.
Roman.
Which were considered, you know, because they sacrificed the false gods, they wouldn't take them in the temple. So they changed them.
Jews coming from all over, some probably coming with Roman money, most of them, I would imagine, not without animals for the sacrifice. So this was put together as a convenience, if you will. And if you all remind me, I've got you a question about that convenience later. So he finds those in the temple doing business. Verse 15. What did Jesus do?
Took some cords, made like a whip, and then
drove them out. When he had made a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money, overturned the tables, and he said to those who sold doves, take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of merchandise.
Okay. It may have been for convenience, but you know the priests were making money off of that.
You think? You know.
That's why I've said Jesus.
We rent the space to them. We let them do that. Now, the question about convenience, though, do you think that's the only place they could have set up? I don't know enough about Jerusalem, but there would have been many places you probably could have set this up. But like Keith said, it very well maybe somebody's making some money off of it. And I could justify that, you know, if I wanted to. But Jesus' position was, don't do that. Don't make my father's house a house of merchandise. And it's interesting to me, who did he say, whose father? My father. Okay, first glimpse maybe of one of the first glimpses of this relationship. Josh.
And also, as we're going to find out, even in this chapter, beyond this, it's very well clear, which we know in hindsight, that Christ knew the hearts of these individuals. He knew the mindset. The temple was a place of worship. It wasn't a place of business or transaction.
sacrifices didn't mean anything if the worship was a part of the thing. It talks about that. That's all in the Old Testament. And you have to believe that. Well, absolutely. I agree. And these are contributors to exactly what he said. And, you know, they were most likely making money, which takes the worship side out. They're just checking off the box. I mean, even for those coming in, this isn't just, hey, we got to do this. It's going to be right here set up for you. You don't have to do anything. Let's have your money ready. We'll do this and we'll make this right. And you know, to go back to what we were studying with David, Wednesday's lesson, you know, David would have no part in someone giving him anything. Granted, they weren't giving anybody anything. But the idea is where the heart is in that sacrifice to God. And all of that was taken out of it. This was just a routine that everybody was going through. And there was, I mean, I can't speak for everyone, but I'm just saying that in most like poor people who were trying to do the right way. But it's a lesson even for us today. Yes, we have the convenience of having packets back there with this or that. We have the convenience of marriage. We have the convenience of travel and all these things. But when we come here, we have to remember, while yes, this is something we're commanded to do, the heart determines the profitability. It's not me. I can sit right here and sing songs and listen to Brent, listen to you, but that don't really mean anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection is the reference that Josh is making to David, it was when David wanted to make a sacrifice on that threshing floor, and the man that owned it offered it to him. Here, have it. And David's famous statement was, I will not offer sacrifice to God that didn't cost me something. Is that not the same piece of ground that the temple is built on? I've got it in my head that that's the same piece of ground that ultimately the temple was built on. I may be wrong. That's something I'll check this afternoon. But just so you get some, I don't know that we have anything that might resemble these three feasts that the Jews were supposed to do in magnitude. Maybe Thanksgiving or Christmas maybe is likened to that, but it's not the same in that there wasn't one place it's supposed to happen. You know, can you imagine if everybody in Mississippi that was going to observe Christmas or Thanksgiving, they're supposed to go to the Hollis's house? That'd be a pretty big undertaking, right? Just so you get some magnitude, Josephus, the Jewish historian, recounted one year at the Passover that 256,000 lambs were sacrificed. And he makes the notation that with that many lambs, that the men that were there outnumbered the lambs 10 to 1. So that would be 2.5 million men that were there. You know, I think of a city today, 2.5 million, that's a pretty big place. You know, bigger places, but that's a pretty big place. And Jerusalem is not that size all the time. There is a lot of stuff going on in Jerusalem during the Passover, and probably very similar with the other feast. If that just gives you some idea about this, I think Philip's term was this marketplace that was being set up. And just think of the money that would change hands with 256,000 lambs being sold. It's not only a big feast, but it became big business. And if their heart wasn't there, they kind of messed up. Reed.
Also, I mean, you think about the time, you know, you've got, what, 3 days for Passover, and they've got to slaughter that many during that time, but it just became an assembly line. I'm guessing it just had to be just this constant flow of people coming in, paying for their animal, and going straight to the, and then it had to be going, well, I guess they can't do it at night, but I mean, that's a massive undertaking to do that.
I make the point about the number of people there to make the point of Jesus is making a stand. With this many people that could potentially be witnesses or hear about it, story gets told. Did you hear about what happened over at the temple complex today? And just to think about 256,000 lambs offered in sacrifice, that'd be a big undertaking in and of itself. Lesson five for next week, we will finish the last couple of verses here. There's one or two more things I wanted to say. Thank you.